This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
One of my treasured possessions is a black and white photograph that's now nearly 30 years old. Two alert-looking elderly gentlemen are looking straight to camera. The taller one, apple-cheeked, has a knowing twinkle in his eye. The shorter, a slightly quizzical look. They're both around 80, and between them stands a younger man, looking pleased but nervous. The photograph was taken in 1985, at the premiere of the restored Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, a film originally made by Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger at the height of the Second World War, and in the teeth of official opposition, led by Winston Churchill, who thundered in a truly blimpish memo from September 1942, "Pray propose to me the measures necessary to stop this foolish production." You'd think he'd have had better things to worry about. But in fact, he couldn't stop it, and cinemas cheerfully advertised, "See the banned film." No one was more delighted by Blimp's resurrection than Emmerich Pressburger, whose favourite it was of all the 21 films he made with Michael Powell between 1939 and 1972. Seeing it restored to its full, glorious 2¾ hours was a dream come true, although as a staunch admirer of Churchill, he was still embarrassed by all the hoo-ha about trying to ban it. For Emmerich, the film was a love letter to England and all he admired about this eccentric, obtuse, yet admirable country. It's a patchwork of gaps, absences, misunderstandings woven around two contrasting figures, the gallant, upright officer Clive Candy and his German counterpart Theodor Kretschmar Schulldorff. And I think it can be understood on at least two levels. One is about seeing relations between Britain and Germany differently, despite the war. These young officers meet because of a supposed international insult, but in spite of two subsequent wars, they also become lifelong friends, as the two nations could have been. On another level, it's about the attraction of opposites, and perhaps about its authors. Michael, a man of Kent and quintessentially English, and Emmerich, born Imre in what was still the Austro-Hungarian Empire. I first met them both in the 1970s, when I went to work at the British Film Institute, with a burning ambition to make their films better known, as indeed they are today, with admirers all over the world, including Martin Scorsese, Stephen Fry and Tilda Swinton. Back in 1977, the National Film Theatre reckoned that showing half a dozen of their best films might be enough. But in the end, we screened over 30 programmes, and as a result, I became friends with The Archers, which was the joint signature they'd adopted in early 1942. Michael could be a formidable figure, even in later life, as he sized you up with a piercing stare. There were stories of him reducing actors to tears, but also examples of him giving others their first break, and sticking loyally by old comrades. At that memorable night when the restored Blimp was screened in a small Hampstead cinema, the guests included Esmond Knight, an actor blinded during the war, whom Powell continued to cast in films right up to Peeping Tom, and Kathleen Byron, unforgettable as the hysterical Sister Ruth in Black Narcissus. We didn't know then that she and Michael had been romantically involved, or that he'd been on the brink of marrying Deborah Carr, who plays Clive Candy's recurring feminine ideal in Blimp. All this would emerge from Michael's eloquently candid memoir, A Life in Movies, a year later. He'd already finished the manuscript when that photo was taken, and his half-smile now seems to be looking forward to the furore that the book would stir. Michael was a truly cosmopolitan Englishman, as much at home in France, where he'd first worked in film, as elsewhere in Europe, North America, and even Australia. His motto was Kipling's famous line, "What do they know of England, who only England know?" Emmerich was also cosmopolitan, of necessity. Born in the provincial Hungarian town of Miskolc, where I've just been involved in helping to name a street after him, he studied in Prague and nearly starved in Berlin before becoming a scriptwriter at the giant Ufa studio. After Hitler came to power, he moved to France and then to Britain, experiences that left him wary and shy of personal publicity. I got to know him when my wife and I visited him in Suffolk at Shoemaker's Cottage, named after the Archer's much-loved classic The Red Shoes, where a weekend of Emmerich's lavish Central European gastronomy left us barely able to move for days. David Lowe's satirical cartoons of Colonel Blimp had lampooned conservatism throughout the 1930s. The Colonel often holds court in a Turkish bath, surrounded by like-minded clubmen, with speeches like, "Gad, sir, Lord Revebeer is right. We should explain to the natives in India that British troops are only there to protect them from massacre. And if they don't accept that, then shoot 'em all down." Emmerich and Michael first show the good Colonel in that familiar Turkish bath setting, where a heavily padded Roger Livesey blusters about his long years of service, after being caught napping, literally, by a young lieutenant determined to show that the Home Guard don't understand total war. But what follows is unexpected. As Clive Candy wrestles with the interloper, they fall into the pool, from which Clive emerges 40 years younger. He's just back from the Cape, after being imprisoned by the Boers and winning a VC, a young blood around town. Before long, he's blundered into a diplomatic disaster in Berlin, and while defending Britain's honour in a duel, he falls in love with Edith, an English governess, who was its ostensible cause, Deborah Carr's first role in the film. But he also meets the man who scars his face with a sabre and becomes his best friend. The duel scene is one of the most audacious in Michael Powell's whole career as a director, because of what we don't see. According to the script, the movement of the camera quickens, it sweeps away from the fighters and high above them. They and their seconds are small figures in the middle of the vast, brightly lit hall. Michael certainly staged this great moment, but it could have been Emmerich who suggested that they didn't need to show the actual duel. What's certain, though, is that it was a more equal partnership than many have assumed, with Emmerich leaving the studio floor to Michael, but active in casting and editing as well as scripting. For the early part of Blimp, Michael, as a Conan Doyle fan, would certainly have thought of references to The Hound of the Baskervilles, which was being serialised at the time, while Emmerich's research in the British Museum turned up a German duelling manual used for the build-up of that scene, and a long-forgotten play, Stephen Phillips' Ulysses, a London hit in 1902, which Clive goes to see. He's an innocent. For all his soldiering and travel round the Empire, covered in a montage of big game heads that build up on the wall of his aunt's house, there's something unworldly about him. This is revealed in a simple scene that I find one of the most poignant. Barbara, whom Clive has married because she resembles Edith, and this is Deborah Carr's second role in the film, has missed meeting Theo and is hearing about the evening from Clive.
Well, I think we made an impression on him. And the last thing I said to him was, "My dear fella, don't you worry. We'll soon have Germany on her feet again."
And he believed it?
Theo, I believe so. I hope so.
Darling. Don't hum.
Was I humming?
Mm-hmm. It's a little habit you've got.
Well, what do I do if I don't hum?
There's definitely a hint of Winnie the Pooh there. And we know that Michael invented the scene to show the love between Clive and Barbara in a very English domestic setting, with his own spaniels in shot, and, of course, his beloved Deborah. Emmerich was unimpressed, but accepted it, which also tells us a lot about the give and take of the Powell-Pressburger relationship. And typically, in this film about ageing and coping with loss, we only learn from a newspaper notice that Barbara dies during the 1920s, as Theo's wife Edith will also die young. Apart from daring to admit that there were still plenty of blimps around, the film's boldest message in 1943 was that not all Germans were Nazis, and many had suffered under Nazi rule. This falls to Anton Walbrook, an Austrian actor who first came to Britain in the 1930s and whose modulation of Theo from stiff young officer to weary refugee is a perfect foil to Roger Livesey's Clive. Theo's account of why he's seeking asylum in Britain after Munich is a moving monologue by Walbrook, and even without drawing on Emmerich's own experience, it clearly comes from the hearts of these two refugees.
My wife was English. She would have loved to come back to England, but it seemed to me that I would be letting down my country in its greatest need, and so she stayed at my side. When in summer 33 we found that we had lost our children to the Nazi party, and I was willing to come. She died. None of my sons came to her funeral. Heil Hitler. And then in January 35, I had to go to Berlin on a mission for my firm. Driving up in my car, I lost my way on the outskirts of the city, and suddenly, the landscape seemed so familiar to me. And slowly I recognized the road, the lake, and a nursing home where I spent some weeks recovering, almost 40 years ago. I stopped the car and sat still, remembering. And you see, in this very nursing home, sir, I met my wife for the first time. And I met an Englishman who became my greatest friend. And I remember the people at the station in 19, when we prisoners were sent home, cheering us, treating us like friends. The faces of a party of distinguished men round the table who tried their utmost to comfort me when the defeat of my country seemed to me unbearable. And very foolishly, I remember the English countryside, the gardens, the weedy rivers and the trees she loved so much. And a great desire came over me to come back to my wife's country.
That scene still brings tears to my eyes. Emmerich is trying to convey what Britain meant to continentals of his generation, to make us understand why winning the war was so important, not just for Britain, but for everyone. You can appreciate how hurt he was that Churchill didn't understand the message and thought it was merely bringing the army into disrepute. Blimp was actually a huge success on its release in mid-1943, one of Britain's first great Technicolor films, and welcomed by many British filmgoers for its quirky humour and lack of Hollywood heroics. But it was later cut and reassembled without the great flashback structure, and then forgotten. Having helped to get the film restored, and then seeing Michael and Emmerich enjoy the belated recognition of their achievement, was one of my proudest moments, which is probably why I look slightly dazed in that photograph. Blimp has been called Britain's answer to Citizen Kane, a national epic ingeniously told as the life of an enigmatic individual, although in truth it's more mock heroic, and tinged with a kind of post-imperial melancholy. Michael knew very well that there's more to Kipling than jingoism, while Emmerich wanted to celebrate aspects of the English character that the locals don't necessarily appreciate. What made The Archers so special? In his second volume of autobiography, Michael describes visiting Emmerich in Suffolk, where they tackle a stupendous lunch washed down with Prague beer. Sitting in the garden, Emmerich speculates about their 50-year partnership. The only secret is that we were amateurs. Left alone by a benevolent producer to develop their own quirky take on Englishness in Blimp, A Canterbury Tale, and A Matter of Life and Death, they enjoyed pricking pomposity and surprising their audiences. Serious rather than cynical, like true amateurs, they accepted each other's weaknesses and combined their strengths. That imaginary visit to Shoemaker's cottage, dated to the day of Emmerich's death, was Michael's way of summing up their partnership, and it appeared in the final volume of his memoirs, Million Dollar Movie, a year after his own death in 1991. But all the evidence is that remaining strictly amateur brought the Archers an immortality that few filmmakers can imagine.